He felt himself perfectly poised at the midpoint between wonder and dread, and didn't know which to feel. Dread it had to be, because he'd glimpsed dread on Errol Fane's face. But how could he not feel wonder at such a sight?
"That," said Errol Fane, "is the citadel of the Mazathim."
"Mazathim?" said Laszlo,
at the same moment that Thion Nero asked, "Citadel?" Their voices clashed, and their glances too.
"Citadel, palace, prison," said Errol Fane.
His voice was rough and dropped almost to nothing on the last word.
"That's a building?"
Eblis Todd demanded, brash and incredulous. His cloud spire, it would seem, was not the tallest structure in the world. The height of the thing was but one element of its magnificence, and not even the foremost. It was tall, certainly. Even at a distance of miles, it was clearly massive. But how to properly gauge its height, in light of the fact that it didn't stand upon the ground? The thing was floating. It was fixed in space, absolutely motionless, high above the city with no possible means of suspension. Unless, indeed, there was some scaffolding in the heavens. It was composed of dazzling blue metal, with an almost mirror shine to it, as smooth as water, and nowhere rectilinear or planar, but all flowing contours, as supple as skin. It didn't look like a thing built or sculpted, but rather poured of molten metal. Laszlo could scarcely decide what was more extraordinary, that it was floating, or that it took the form of an immense being. Because here was where his wild and improbable theory came wildly and improbably true, in a manner of speaking. The entire impossible structure took the form of a seraph. It was a statue too huge to be conceived. Upright, straight, feet toward the city, head in the sky, arms outheld in a pose of supplication. Its wings were spread wide. Its wings. The great metal span of them. They were fanned out to such a tremendous breadth that they made a canopy over the city, blocking out the sunlight, moonlight, starlight, all natural light. This wasn't what Laszlo had meant by his theory, even in jest. But he was hard-pressed now to say which was wilder or more improbable. The return of mythic beings from beyond the sky, or a 1,000-foot-high metal statue of one hovering in the air. The imagination, he thought, no matter how vivid, was still tethered in some measure to the known. And this was beyond anything he could have imagined. If the Godslayer had told them in advance, it would have sounded absurd, even to him. The delegates found their voices and poured forth a deluge of questions.
"How is it floating?
What is that metal?
Who made it? How did it get there?"
Laszlo asked.
"Who are the Mazathim?"
And that was the first question Errol Fane answered, sort of.
"The question is, who were the Mazathim? They're dead now."
Laszlo thought he saw a trace of grief in the Godslayer's eyes, and he couldn't make sense of it. The Mazathim could only be the gods whose deaths had earned him his name. But if he had killed them, why should he grieve?
"And that," he added, nodding to it, "is dead too."
"What do you mean it's dead?"
someone asked.
"Was it alive, that thing?"
"Not exactly," said Errol Fane. "But it moved as though it were. It breathed."
He wasn't looking at anyone. He seemed very far away. He fell silent, facing the immensity of the strangeness before them, and then breathed out.
"When the sun rose that day, 200 years ago, it was there. When the people came out of their houses and looked up and saw it, there were many who rejoiced. We have always worshipped the seraphim here, It might sound like a fairy tale to some of you, but our temples are timbered with the bones of demons, and it is no fairy tale to us.
He gestured toward the great metal angel.
Our holy book tells of a second coming. This isn't what anyone thought it would look like, but many wanted to believe. Our priestesses have always taught that divinity, by virtue of its great power, must encompass both beauty and terror. And here were both.
He shook his head.
But in the end, the form of the citadel might only have been a twisted joke. Whatever they were, the Mazathim weren't seraphim.
The whole party was silent. All the Ferengi looked as dazed as Laszlo felt. Some brows creased as rational minds grappled with this proof of the impossible, or at least the hitherto inconceivable. Others were smooth on faces gone slack with astonishment. The Tizerkane looked grim, and, this was odd, but Laszlo noticed, first seeing Azarine and the way she kept her eyes pinned on Errol Fane, that none of them were looking at the citadel. Not Ruza or Tzara or anyone. It seemed to Laszlo they were looking anywhere but there, as though they couldn't bear the sight of the thing.
They didn't have wings. They weren't beings of fire. Like the Seraphim, though, there were six of them. Three male, three female. No army, no servants. They needed none, said Errol Fane. They had magic.
He gave a bitter smile.
Magic isn't a fairy tale, either, as we here have cause to know. I wanted you to see this before I tried to explain. I knew your minds would fight it. Even now, with the proof before you, I can see you're struggling.
Where did they come from?
Calixte asked. Errol Fane just shook his head.
We don't know.
But you say they were gods?
Asked Muzave, the natural philosopher, who was hard-pressed to believe in the divine.
What is a god? Was Errol Fane's reply. I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you this. The Mazathim were powerful, but they were nothing holy.
He sank into silence, and they waited to see if he would break it. There were so many questions they wanted to ask, but even Drave, the explosionist, felt the pathos of the moment and held his tongue. When Errol Fane did speak, though, it was only to say,
It's getting late. You'll want to reach the city.
We're going there?
Some among them demanded, fear thick in their voices.
Right underneath that thing?
It's safe, the Godslayer assured them. I promise you, it's just a shell now. It's been empty for 15 years.
Then what's the problem?
Thion Nero asked.
Why exactly have you brought us here?
Laszlo was surprised he hadn't figured it out. He gazed at the dazzling behemoth and the darkness beneath it.
The shadow of our dark time still haunts us.
Errol Fane might have slain the gods and freed his people from thrall. But that thing remained, blocking out the sun and lording their long torment over them.
To get rid of it,
he told the alchemist, as sure as he had ever been of anything.
And give the city back its sky.
Chapter 22. Pattern of light, scribble of darkness. Laszlo looked up at the shining citadel of alien blue metal floating in the sky. Sarai looked down at the gleam of the cusp, beyond which the sun was soon to sink, and at the fine thread winding down the valley toward Weep. It was the trail. Squinting, she could just make out a progress of specks against the white. Laszlo was one of the specks. Around them both, Voices jangled and jarred. Speculation, debate, alarm. But they heard them only as noise. Both were absorbed in their own thoughts. Laszlo's mind was afire with marvel, the lit match touching off fuse after fuse. Burning lines raced through his consciousness, connecting far-flung dots and filling in blanks, erasing question marks and adding a dozen more for everyone erased. A dozen. There could be no end to the questions, but the sketch outlines of answers were beginning to appear, and they were astonishing. If his absorption were a pattern of light, though, Sarai's was a scribble of darkness. For 15 years, she and the others had survived in hiding, trapped in the citadel of murdered gods and scraping a meager existence from it. And maybe they had always known this day would come, but the only life, the only sanity, had been in believing it could be held at bay. Now those specks in the distance, almost too small to be seen, were coming inexorably toward them, to attempt to dismantle their world, and what tatters remained of Sarai's belief deserted her. The Godslayer had returned to weep. She had always known who her father was, long before she ever screamed moths and sent her senses down to the city. She knew about the man who had loved and killed her mother, and who would have killed her too, if she had been in the nursery with the others. Images rose from her arsenal of horrors. His strong hand, drawing a knife across Isagol's throat. Children and babies screaming, the bigger ones thrashing in the arms of their killers. Spuming arterial fountains, leaping sprays of red.
"The throat's better,"
the old woman had said in Sarai's nightmare. She reached up to her own throat and wrapped her hands around it, as though she could protect it. Her pulse was frantic, her breathing ragged, and it seemed impossible that people could live at all with such flimsy stuff as skin keeping blood, breath, and spirit safe inside their bodies. At the garden balustrade in the citadel of the Mazarthim, with the ghosts peering over their shoulders, the godspawn watched their death ride down to weep. And in the sky overhead, empty, 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 and then not. A white bird appeared in the blue, like the tip of a knife stabbed through a veil. And wherever it had been, and however it had come, it was here now, and it was watching. Part 3. Mahal, noun. A risk that will yield either tremendous reward or disastrous consequence. Archaic, from the Mahalath, a transformative fog of myth that turns one either into a god or a monster. Chapter 23. Unseen no longer. Fabled weep, unseen no longer. From the top of the cusp, where the Godslayer's delegation stood, a trail descended into the canyon of the river Uzamark, with the white of demon glass gradually giving way to the honey-coloured stone of cliff faces and natural spires and arches, and to the green of forests so dense that their canopies looked, from above, like carpets of moss one might walk across, and the waterfalls might have been curtains of pale silk hung from the cliff-tops, too numerous to count. With its waterfall curtains and carpets of forest, the canyon was like a long and beautiful room, and weep a toy city, a gilded model, at its center. The shocking serenity of the citadel, the sheer size of the thing, played havoc with the mind's sense of scale.
"Does Errol Fane want me to climb that?"
Calixte asked, staring up at the great seraph.
"What's the matter? I couldn't do it,"
taunted Eblis Todd.
"Have to reach it first," she quipped. "I suppose that's where you come in."
She waved her hand at him queenly.
"Be a dear and build me some stairs."
Todd's umbrage rendered him momentarily speechless. during which pause Suldarin interjected.
Be faster to fly, anyway. We can have the silk sleighs ready in a few days. That's just getting to it, though,
her husband, Oswin, pointed out.
That'll be the easy part. Getting rid of it, now, there's another matter. What do you reckon?
Suldarin mused.
Move it. Dismantle it. Blow it up,
said Drave, which drew him flat looks from everyone.
You do see that it's directly above the city,
Laszlo pointed out.
So, they get out of the way.
I imagine they're trying to avoid further destruction.
Then why invite me?
He asked, grinning.
Why, indeed,
Suldarin murmured in an undertone. Drave reached out to smack Thion Nero on the shoulder.
Did you hear that?
He asked, as Thion had failed to laugh.
Why invite me if you don't want destruction, eh? Why bring 10 camels worth of powder if you don't want to blow that thing right back to the heavens?
Thion gave him a thin smile and half nod, though it was clear that his mind was elsewise occupied. No doubt he was processing the problem in his own way. He kept his own counsel, while the other delegates were vociferous. For months their intellects had been hamstrung by mystery. Now the sky presented the greatest scientific puzzle they had ever encountered, and they were all considering their place in it, and their chances of solving it. Muzaev was talking to Belabra about magnets, but Belabra wasn't listening. He was muttering indecipherable calculations, while the Fellerings, the twin metallurgists, discussed the possible composition of the blue metal. As for Laszlo, he was awed and humbled. He'd known from the first that he had no qualifications to recommend him for the Godslayer's delegation. But it wasn't until he beheld the problem that he realized that some part of him had still hoped he might be the one to solve it. Ridiculous. A storybook might have held the secret of Azoth, and knowledge of stories might have earned him a place in the party, but he hardly thought that tales would give him an edge now. Well, but he was here, and he would help in any way he could, even if it was only running errands for the delegates. What was it Master Hurrican had said?
Some men are born for great things, and others to help great men do great things.
He'd also said there was no shame in it, and Laszlo agreed. Still, was it too much to hope that the man born for great things should not turn out to be Thion Nero? Anyone but him, thought Laszlo, laughing a little at his own pettiness. The caravan descended the trail into the valley, and Laszlo looked about himself, amazed. He was really here, seeing it. A canyon of golden stone, swathes of unbroken forest, a great green river blurred by waterfall mist, flowing as far as the shadow of the citadel. There, just shy of the city, the Uzumark broadened into a delta, and was sliced into ribbons by boulders and small islands before simply vanishing. Beyond the city it reappeared and continued its tumultuous journey eastward and away. The river, it seemed, flowed under the city. From a distance, Weep was stunningly like Laszlo's long-held picture of it, or at least like his long-held picture as seen through a veil of shadow. There were the golden domes, though fewer than he'd pictured, and they didn't gleam. The sunlight didn't strike them. By the time the sun angled low enough to slant its rays under the citadel's outspread wings, it had gone beyond the edge of the cusp, and only traded one shadow for another. But it was more than that. There was a forlorn look about it, a sense of lingering despair. There were the city's defensive walls, built in a harmonious oval, but the harmony was broken. In 4 places, the wall was obliterated. Set down with geometric precision at the cardinal points were 4 monumental slabs of the same alien metal as the citadel. They were great tapered blocks, each as big in its own right as a castle. But they appeared entirely smooth, windowless and doorless. They looked, from above, like a set of great map weights holding down the city's edges so it wouldn't blow away. It was difficult to make out from this distance, but there seemed to be something atop each one. A statue, perhaps.
"What are those great blocks?"
he asked Ruza, pointing.
"Those are the anchors."
"Anchors?" Laszlo squinted across the distance, gauging the block's position relative to the great seraph overhead. It appeared to be centered in the air above them.
"Do they act like anchors?"
he asked. He thought of ships in harbor, in which case there would be anchor chain. Nothing visible connected the seraph to the blocks.
"Are they keeping it from drifting away?"
Ruza's smile was wry.
"They never took the time to explain it to us, Strange. They set them down the day they came, never mind what was under them. And there they are still."
Ruza jerked his head at the procession behind them.
"Think one of these geniuses will be able to move them?"
"Move the anchors?
Do you think that's how to move the citadel?" Ruza shrugged.
"Or what? Attach tow lines to it and pull? All I know is it won't be leaving the way it came. Not with Scathis dead."
Scathis. The name was like a serpent's hiss. Laszlo took it in, and the realization dawned that Ruza was talking. Well, he was always talking. The fine point was, the secrecy that had bound them all until now was apparently broken. Laszlo could ask questions. He turned to his friend.
"Don't look at me like that," said Ruza.
"Like what?"
"Like I'm a beautiful book you're about to open and plunder with your greedy mad eyes."
Laszlo laughed.
"Greedy mad eyes? Plunder? Are you afraid of me, Ruza?"
Ruza looked suddenly steely.
"Do you know, Strange, that to ask a Tizer King if he fears you is to challenge him to single combat?"
"Well then,"
said Laszlo, who knew better than to believe anything Ruza said.
"I'm glad I only said it to you, and not one of the fearsome warriors like Azarine or Tzara."
"Unkind,"
said Ruza, wounded. His face crumpled. He pretended to weep.
"I am fearsome,"
he insisted.
"I am."
"There, there,"
Laszlo consoled.
"You're a very fierce warrior. Don't cry. You're terrifying."
"Really?"
asked Ruza in a pitiful little hopeful voice.
"You're not just saying that?"
"You two idiots,"
said Azarine. And Laszlo felt a curious twinge of pride, to be called an idiot by her, with what might have been the tiniest edge of fondness. He exchanged a chastened glance with Ruza, as Azarine passed them on the trail and took the lead. A short time ago, Laszlo had seen her arguing with Errol Fane, and had heard just enough to understand that she'd wanted to stay with him at Fort Mizrach.
"Why must you face everything alone?"
she had demanded, before turning away and leaving him there. And when Laszlo last looked back to wave, the caravan starting down the trail and the Godslayer staying behind, he had seemed not only diminished, but haunted. If it was safe in the city, as he promised, then why did he look like that? And why did he not come with them? What happened here? Laszlo wondered. He didn't ask any more questions. In silence, they rode the rest of the way down to weep. Errol Fane stood on the ridge and watched the caravan make its way to the city. It took them an hour to reach it, weaving in and out of view among stands of trees, and by the time they left the forest for good, they were too distant for him to make out who was who. He could tell Spectral from Camel, and that was all. It was getting dark, which didn't help. Azarine would be leading. She would be straight-backed, face forward, and no one behind her would suspect the look on her face. The loneliness. The raw, bewildered mourning. He did that to her, over and over. If she would only give up on him, he could stop destroying her. He could never be what she hoped for, what he had once been. Before he was a hero, before he was even a man, before he was the lover of the goddess of despair. Errol Fane shuddered. Even after all these years, the thought of Isagold the Terrible stirred such a storm in him, of rancor and longing, desire and disgust, violence and even affection. All of it seething and bleeding and writhing, like a pit of rats eating one another alive. That was what his feelings were now, what Isagol had made of them. Nothing good or pure could survive in him. All was corruption and gore, suffocating in his self-loathing. How weak he was, how pitiful. He might have killed the goddess in the end, but he wasn't free of her, and he never would be. If only Azarine would let him go. Every day that she waited for him to become who he had been, he bore the burden of her loneliness in addition to his own. His mother's, too. At least he could send her Laszlo to take care of, and that would help. But he couldn't very well send someone home with Azarine to take his place as her husband. Only she could make that choice, and she wouldn't. Errol Fane had told Laszlo he didn't sleep well in Weep. Well, that rather downplayed the matter. It turned his blood cold to even think of closing his eyes in the city. Even from up here, where distance made a toy of it, a pretty glimmer of far-off glaives and old gold. He felt its atmosphere like tentacles waiting to drag him back in, and he couldn't stop shaking. Better that no one should see him like this. If the Godslayer couldn't keep his countenance, how could anyone else? Feeling like the world's greatest coward, he turned away from his city, and his guests, and his wife, whom he could not love, because he could not love. And he rode the short track back to Fort Mizrach. Tomorrow, he told himself. Tomorrow he would face Weep, and his duty, and the nightmares that stalked him. Somehow, he would find the courage to finish what he had started 15 years ago, and free his people from this last vestige of their long torment. Even if he could never free himself. Chapter 24 Obscenity, Calamity, Godspawn.
"I told you we'd die before we ran out of dresses,"
said Ruby, and all of her saucy bravado was gone. She might have been blithe about dying when it was abstraction, but she wasn't now.
"No one's dying," said Feral. "Nothing's changed."
They all looked at him.
"Nothing except the Godslayer's back,"
Ruby pointed out.
"With clever men and women from the outside world,"
Sparrow added.
"Intent on destroying us,"
Minya concluded.
"Not destroying us," argued Feral. "They don't know we're here."
"And what do you think they'll do when they find us?"
asked Minya.
"Express polite surprise and apologize for barging into our home."
"It won't come to that," he said. "How would they get anywhere near us? It's not as though they can fly. We're safe up here."
He was dismissive, but Sarai could tell that he was worried too. It was the outsiders. What did the five of them know of the rest of the world and the capabilities of its people? Nothing at all. They were on the garden terrace, which was at the top of the great seraph's breast, stretching from shoulder to shoulder, and overlooked the city all the way to the cusp. Helplessly, they watched the procession of specks move down the slope and disappear inside the city. Sarai was between plum trees, her hands trembling, resting on the balustrade. Over the edge was nothing but empty air, a straight drop far, far down to the rooftops. She was uneasy, standing so close. She made the descent every night through her moth's senses. But that was different. The moths had wings. She did not. She took a careful step back and wrapped her hand around a strong branch. Ruby was reckless, though, leaning too far out.
"Where do you suppose they are now?"
she asked. She picked a plum and threw it out as hard as she could. Sparrow gasped. They watched the fruit arc out into air.
"Ruby, what are you doing?"
Sparrow demanded.
"Maybe I'll hit one of them." "The rule." "The rule,"
Ruby repeated, rolling her eyes.
"You think they don't fall off the trees by themselves? Oh, look, a plum."
She mimicked picking something up, examining it, then tilting back her head to gaze up.
"Must be someone living up there. Let's go kill them."
"I hardly think a plum would survive the fall," Feral pointed out. Ruby gave him the flattest look that had, perhaps, ever been given in all of time. Then, unexpectedly, she began to laugh. She clutched her middle and doubled over.
"I hardly think a plum would survive the fall,"
she repeated, laughing harder.
"And how about me?"
she asked. She flung a leg over the balustrade, and Sarai's stomach dropped.
"Do you think I'd survive the fall? Now that would be breaking the rule."
Sparrow gasped.
"Enough,"
said Sarai, jerking Ruby back.
"Don't be stupid."
She could feel panic pulsing beneath the skin of the moment, and made an effort to smother it.
"Feral's right. It's too soon to worry." "It's never too soon to worry,"
said Minya, who, unlike the rest of them, didn't seem worried in the least. On the contrary, she seemed excited.
"Worry spurs preparation." "What kind of preparation?"
Sparrow asked, a quaver slipping into her voice. She looked around at her garden, and at the graceful arches of the gallery, through which the dining table could be seen, and the ghost, Ariel, still standing rigid where Minya had left him. A breeze stirred the drapery of vines that were the only things standing between outside and in.
"We can't hide,"
she said.
"If we could just shut the doors..."
Doors in the citadel were nothing like the hand-carved timber ones Sarai knew from the city. They didn't swing open and shut. They didn't latch or lock. They weren't objects at all, but only apertures in the smooth mesartheum. The open ones were apertures, anyway. Closed, they weren't doors at all, but only smooth expanses of wall, because back when the citadel was alive, the metal had simply melted open and shut, reforming seamlessly.
"If we could shut the doors,"
Minya reminded her slowly,
"that would mean we could control mesartheum. And if we could control mesartheum, we could do a lot more than shut the doors."
There was an acid edge to her voice. Minya, being Scathus's daughter, had always had a festering bitterness at the core of her that she hadn't inherited his power, the one power that could have set them free. It was the rarest of gifts, and Koriko had monitored the babies closely for any sign of it. In all of Great Ellen's years in the nursery, it had manifested only once, and Koriko had taken the baby away on the spot. Mesartheum was no ordinary metal. It was perfectly adamant, impenetrable, unassailable. It could not be cut or pierced. No one had ever succeeded in making so much as a scratch in it. Nor did it melt. The hottest forge fire and the strongest blacksmith could make not the slightest dent in it. Even Ruby's fire had no effect on it. At Scathus's will, however, It had rippled, shifted, reshaping itself into new configurations with the fluidity of mercury. Hard and cool to the touch, it had, nevertheless, been molten to his mind, and the creatures who gave him his title, God of Beasts, instead of merely God of Metal, had been, for all intents and purposes, living things. They were four Mazarthian monsters, one to each of the huge metal blocks positioned at the perimeter of the city. Rasselas had been his favorite, and though the citizens of Weep had understood that the beast was only metal, animated by Scathus's mind, the understanding was buried under their terror. Their fear of him was its own entity, and Sarai understood why. Thousands upon thousands of times, she'd seen him in their dreams, and it was hard even for her not to believe he had been alive. The citadel in the sky had seemed alive too. Back then, anyone looking up at it was likely to find it looking back with its immense, inscrutable eyes. Such had been Scathus's gift. If they'd had it, then the doors would be an afterthought. They could bring the whole citadel back to life and move it anywhere they wanted, though Sarai didn't imagine there was anywhere in the world that would want them.
"Well, we can't, can we?" said Sparrow. "And we can't fight." "You can't,"
agreed Minya with scorn, as though Sparrow's gift, which had kept them fed for years, had no worth because it had no dimension for violence.
"And you,"
she said to Feral with equal scorn.
"If we wanted to frighten them with thunder, then you might be useful."
She had goaded him for years to learn to summon and aim lightning, with dismal results. It was beyond his control, and though this was due to the natural parameters of his gift and no personal failing, it didn't spare him Minya's judgment. Her eyes flicked to Sarai next, and here her gaze went beyond scorn to something more combative. Spite, frustration, venom. Sarai knew it all. She'd endured its sting ever since she stopped blindly doing everything Minya told her to do.
"And then there's Bonfire,"
Minya said, moving on to Ruby without scorn so much as cool consideration.
"What's about me?"
asked Ruby, wary. Minya's gaze focused in on her.
"Well, I suppose you might do more with your gift than heat bathwater and burn up your clothes."
Ruby paled to a bloodless cerulean.
"You mean burn people?"
Minya let out a little laugh.
"You're the only one of the five of us who's actually a weapon, and you've never even considered..."
Ruby cut her off.
"I'm not a weapon."
Minya's mirth vanished. She said coolly,
"When it comes to the defense of the citadel and our five lives, yes, you are."
Sometimes you can glimpse a person's soul in just a flicker of expression. And Sarai glimpsed Ruby's then, the longing that was the core of her. Yesterday she'd had the thought that Ruby's gift expressed her nature, and it did, but not the way Minya wanted it to. Ruby was heat and volatility. She was passion, but not violence. She wanted to kiss, not kill. It sounded silly, but it wasn't. She was 15 years old and furiously alive, and in a glimmer of a moment, Sarai saw her hopes both exposed and destroyed, and felt in them the echo of her own. To be someone else. To not be this.
"Come on," said Feral. "If it comes to fighting, what chance do you think we have? The Godslayer slew the Mazarthim, and they were far more powerful than we are."
"He had the advantage of surprise,"
said Minya, all but baring her teeth.
"He had the advantage of treachery. Now we have it."
A little sob escaped from Sparrow. Whatever calm they'd been pretending, it was slipping away. No, Minya was tearing it away deliberately.
What's wrong with you?
Sarai wanted to demand, but she knew she would get no satisfaction. Instead, she said, with all the authority she could muster,
We don't know anything yet. Feral's right. It's too soon to worry. I'll find out what I can tonight, and tomorrow we'll know if we need to have this conversation or not. For now, it's dinner time. I'm not hungry, said Ruby.
Neither was Sarai, but she thought if they could act normal, they might feel normal. A little bit, anyway. Though it was hard to feel normal with a ghost glaring at you from the head of the table.
Minya,
she said. It pained her to be gracious, but she forced herself.
Would you please send Ari Isle away so that we can eat in peace?
She didn't ask her to release him. She understood that Minya meant to keep him around, if only to torment Sarai.
Certainly I will, since you ask so nicely,
said Minya, matching her gracious tone with just an edge of mockery. She gave no visible signal, but in the dining room, the ghost unfroze and pivoted toward the interior door. Minya was done toying with him, apparently, because he didn't shuffle his steps or fight against her now, but virtually glided from their sight.
Thank you,
said Sarai, and they went inside. Dinner was not Kimril soup, though Sarai doubted Ruby would have voiced any objection to it tonight. She was uncharacteristically silent, and Sarai could imagine the tenor of her thoughts. Her own were grim enough, and she wasn't faced with the notion of burning people alive. What Feral said was true. They could never win a battle. Once they were discovered, there simply was no scenario in which life went on. She didn't linger in the gallery after dinner, but asked Ruby to heat a bath for her. Their suites all had bathrooms with deep Mazarthium pools in them, but water no longer came from the pipes, so they used a copper tub in the rain room instead. The rain room was the chamber off the kitchens they designated for Feral's cloud summoning. They'd fitted it with barrels, and a channel in the floor caught runoff and funneled it out to the gardens. Kem, the ghost footman, said it had been the butchering room before, and the channel was for blood, and the big hooks on the ceiling were for hanging meat. No trace of blood remained, though, just as none remained in the nursery or the corridors. One of Minya's first commands to the ghosts in the aftermath of the carnage had been to clean up all the blood. Sarai scooped water into the tub with a bucket, and Ruby put her hands on the side and ignited them. Just her hands, like she was holding fireballs. The copper conducted the heat beautifully, and soon the water was steaming, and Ruby left. Sarai submerged herself and soaped, and washed her hair with the soap Great Ellen made them from the herbs in the garden, and all the while she had the peculiar sense that she was preparing herself, as though her body would be going out from the citadel, and not merely her senses. She was even nervous, as if she were about to meet new people. Meet them? Ha! She was about to spy on new people and violate their minds. What did it matter if her hair was clean? They wouldn't see her or have any awareness of her presence. They never did. In Weep, it was she who was the ghost, and an unbound one, invisible, incorporeal, insubstantial as a murmur. Back in her dressing room, she put on a slip. Staring at herself in the mirror, she found that she'd lost the ability to see herself through her own eyes. She saw only what humans would see. Not a girl or a woman or someone in between. They wouldn't see her loneliness or fear or courage, let alone her humanity. They would see only obscenity, calamity, Godspawn. Something took hold of her, a surge of defiance. Her eyes swept the dressing room, past the slips to the terrible gowns, the headdresses and fans, and pots of her mother's face paint, and all the macabre accoutrements of the goddess of despair. And when she emerged, Les Ellen, who had brought her tea, did a double take and nearly dropped her tray.
"Oh, Sarai, you gave me a fright."
"It's just me," said Sarai, though she didn't feel quite herself. She'd never desired to be anything like her mother before, but tonight she craved a little goddess ferocity. So she'd painted Isagol's black band across her eyes from temple to temple, and mussed her cinnamon-red hair as wild as she could make it. She turned to the terrace, which was the outstretched right hand of the huge metal seraph, and went out to meet the knight and the newcomers. Chapter 25 The Knight and the Newcomers. Sarai screamed her moths at Weep, and down they whirled. On a normal night, they would split up and divide the city 100 ways between them, but not tonight. She needed all her focus on the newcomers. Tonight, the citizens of Weep would not weep because of her. The ghost of Ariel had told them, or been compelled by Minya to tell them, that the Ferengi were to be housed at the Merchants' Guild Hall, where a wing had been outfitted as a hostelry just for them. Sarai had never gone there before. It wasn't a residence, so she'd never looked there for sleepers. And it took her a few minutes to locate the right wing. The place was palatial, with a large central structure topped with a golden dome and walls of the native honey stone. All was carved in the traditional style. Weep wasn't a city that feared ornamentation. Centuries of carvers had embellished every stone surface with patterns and creatures and seraphim. Graceful open pavilions were connected by covered walkways to outbuildings capped in smaller domes. There were fountains, and once upon a time there had been gardens full of fruit and flowers, but those had all withered in the accursed shade. The whole city had been a garden once. Not anymore. Orchid Witch, Sarai thought in passing, could do a sight of good down here. If not for the fact that she would be murdered on sight. The moths tested the terrace doors first, but found most of them closed, and far too well made for any cracks that might admit them. So they flew down the chimneys instead. Inside, the rooms were sumptuous, as befitted the first foreign delegation ever welcomed beyond the cusp. For centuries, the city had been famed the world over for its craftsmanship, and these chambers might have served as a showplace. The finest of carpets laid over floors of mosaic gold and lis, with embroidered bedcovers, frescoed walls, carved ceiling timbers, and marvelous objects on shelves and walls, every one a masterpiece. But Sarai wasn't here for the art. Between 11 occupied rooms, she counted 13 sleepers, one of whom was not a Ferengi, but a Tizakane warrior, Tsara, wrapped in the slender arms of a slight young woman with very short, soft hair. That made a dozen outsiders all told, most of whom were musty old men. There was only one other woman, less young, less slender, sleeping beside a stocky man. These were the only couples and the only women. All the rest were men and slept alone. More than half snored. Slightly less than half stank. It was easy to tell who had availed themselves of the baths drawn for them, because their tubs were coated in the brown scum of weeks of unwash. Those with clean tubs simply had not yet transferred the scum from their persons, and Sarai was loath to perch her moths on them. Up in the sky, her nose wrinkled as though she were experiencing the concentrated male stench firsthand. With all her moths divided among so few rooms, she was able to study each person from multiple vantage points and take in every detail of them. Two of the men looked so alike that she grew confused for a moment, thinking that two sets of moths were relaying her the same information. They weren't. She realized the men were twins. One man was especially ill-favored. He had a sour, thin-lipped look even in sleep, and another resembled a reptile in molt, the skin of his face sloughing away in curls of dead skin. His knuckles were gnarled with burn scars, too, like melted candle wax,
and he smelled like a dead animal. The young women were much pleasanter, smooth-skinned and sweet-smelling. Around Sara's navel, Sarai saw the Elilith tattoo, given to all girls of Weep when they become women. Sara's was a serpent swallowing its tail, which symbolized the cycle of destruction and rebirth, and had become popular since the defeat of the gods. The older couple wore matching gold bands on their rough and calloused ring fingers, and the man's nails, like sparrows, bore dark crescents from working with soil. The soil was in the room, too. The elegant table was covered with dozens of little canvas sacks filled with seedlings, and Sarai wondered how plants figured into the Godslayer's plans to conquer the citadel. On one sleeper in particular, though, she found an undue portion of her attention fix, without her even meaning it to. It was an instinctive process, her focus flowing among her sentinels according to need. But this wasn't need. This stranger didn't seem more important than the others. He was simply more beautiful. He was golden. His hair was such a color as she'd never seen. Her own red-brown was unusual enough in Weep, where everyone had black hair, but his was the color of sunlight. Long enough in the front, and with just enough wave to make a curl you wanted to reach out and coax around your finger. Aside from the girl entwined with Sara, he was the only one of the Ferengi who was young, though not so young as Sarai was herself. He was princely and broad-shouldered, and had nodded off propped up on cushions with a book open on his bare chest. Through the moth's vision, Sarai saw that the cover was a picture of a spoonful of stars and creatures, but her attention was drawn to his face, which was every bit as fine an artwork as the room's collection of marvels. There was such an elegance in the lines of it, such a perfect sculpt to every angle and curve, that he was almost unreal, a museum piece. She reminded herself that she wasn't here to be enraptured by this stranger's beauty, but to discover who he was, and what nature of threat he posed, and the same with the rest whose humbler looks presented less distraction. She looked at them all, and they were just sleeping humans, so vulnerable with their slack mouths and their long pale toes poking out from under the covers. With few exceptions, they were very nearly ridiculous. It seemed impossible that they might be the death of her. Enough. She wouldn't learn anything about the Godslayer's guests by looking at them. It was time to look in them. In 11 rooms, where 13 humans slept, 10 men and 3 women, one of whom was not an outsider, and thus not a subject, moths that were perched on the walls and bedposts bestirred themselves and took to the air, fluttering the little distance to land on flesh. None of the humans felt the feather-like feet of winged creatures alighting on their brows and cheekbones, much less the smooth intrusion of the muse of nightmares into their minds. Invisible, incorporeal, insubstantial as a murmur, Sarai slipped into their dreams, and what she discovered there, in the hours that followed, proved that the strangers were far from ridiculous, and would indeed be the death of her. Azarine lived in a set of rooms above a bakery in Windfall, the district so named for the plums that fell on it from the trees of the gods. She walked up the back steps, from the courtyard where the bakery and adjacent tavern kept their waste bins. It stank, and there was that other smell, distinct to Windfall. Ferment. Always the plums were raining down, as though the trees were enchanted and would never die. Azarine hated plums. She put the key in the lock, pushed open the door, and went in. 2 years' worth of dust lay over everything. The blankets would be musty, the cupboards empty. Her mother or sisters would have kept the rooms fresh for her, but having them here would open the door to conversations she didn't wish to have, such as why she still lived here, alone, when she might stay with any of them, or even marry, and have a family, before it was too late. "I'm already married," she would tell them. And what could they say to that? It was true in its way, even if her husband had released her from the promise she'd made 18 years ago, when she was only a girl. 16 years old, and Errol Fane had been all of 17. How beautiful he'd been. They'd been too young to marry, but it hadn't stopped them. In the shadow of the Mazarthim, all time had seemed borrowed, and they just couldn't wait. Oh, the memories. They would surface from the wreckage, fast and sharp enough to impale her. Of wanting him so much, she didn't know how she'd survive a night without him. And then, at last, not having to. Their wedding night. How young and smooth they'd been, and eager and tireless and burning. 5 nights. That was what they'd had. 5 nights, 18 years ago. That was her marriage. And then, what came after? Azarine dropped her pack on the floor and looked around. Small, stifling and quiet. It made quite a change from the Elmuthaleth. She had a sitting room, a bedroom, and a small kitchen with a water closet. She'd stopped by her sister's house to see her family, after settling the Ferengi in at the Guild Hall, and she'd had some dinner there. She needed a bath, but that could wait until the morning. She went straight to her bed, where, 18 years ago, she'd spent 5 eager, tireless, burning nights with her beautiful young husband, before the gods stole him away. The quiet closed in. Azarine imagined she could feel the shadow, the weight and press of the citadel overhead. It was the weight and press of everything that had happened in it, and everything that had never happened because of it. She didn't change her clothes, but just took off her boots and reached into her pack, into the little pocket she'd sewn into it to hold her most cherished possession. It was a ring of tarnished silver. She put it on, as she did always and only at night, tucked her hands under her cheek, and waited for sleep to take her. A mile or so away, down a street paved in lapis lazuli, just like in a mean old monk's childhood tales, in a house much less grand than the Merchant's Guild Hall, and far cosier than Azarine's rooms, Laszlo was just getting to bed. The sun would rise in an hour. He hadn't meant to stay up all night, but how could he help it? He was here.
"There's only one way to celebrate the end of such a journey,"
his hostess had told him when she greeted him at the Merchant's Guild Hall and whisked him away home with her.
"And that is with food, a bath and a bed, in the order of your preference."
Suhaila was her name. Her hair was a cap of white, cropped short as a man's, and her face was a perfect example of how someone can be beautiful without being beautiful. She shone with good nature and the same vitality that Errol Fane radiated, but without the shadow that had grown over him as they drew nearer to weep. There was gravity in her, but nothing grim or bleak. Her eyes were the same deep-set smiles as her son's, with more extensive deltas of creases at the corners. She was short and vigorous, colorfully dressed in an embroidered tunic, adorned with tassels and gathered in by a wide, patterned belt. Discs of hammered gold at her temples were connected by spans of fine chain across her brow.
"You are most welcome here, young man,"
she'd said with such heartfelt sincerity that Laszlo almost felt as if he'd come home. Home, about which he knew as little as he did about mothers. Before today, he had never set foot in a home. As to having a preference, that was new too. You take what you're given and you're grateful for it. Once that message is well and truly ingrained in you, it feels like vain glory to imagine one's own likes and dislikes could matter to other people.
"Whatever order makes the most sense,"
he had replied, almost like a question.
"Sense be damned. You can eat in the bath if that's what you wish. You've earned it."
And Laszlo had never had a bath he'd had any desire to linger in, bathing in the monastery having been characterized by shivering in buckets of well water and at the library by quick, lukewarm pool showers. Still, feeling deeply that his filth was an unforgivable imposition, he chose